Welcome, everyone. Hello, Cathers. Nice to see
you.
Hey,
love. Hey, gang. How is everyone? Welcome back once again to Pop Culture Podcast Straight Up, where we lift the lid on all things fame and celeb. How you doing?
I'm good. All the better for seeing you. And welcome to all of our new listeners. We're getting a lovely little flurry of new fans.
I know. We love you and we love your messages. Keep coming. We're on the spicy marks today.
I know.
A little bit of a fun recording.
Are we ever not on the spicy marks recently?
Right. Let's get into it this week, shall we? Because we've got a whole razzmatazz of topics to get through. We are going to start with perhaps the biggest celeb talking point of the previous week, which was the Cassie allegations against P. Diddy and what's all come about since then. So for listeners that don't know, over the weekend, Cassie filed a $30 million lawsuit against Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, whatever, because she alleges that over a course of a 10-year relationship, which ended in 2018, he was incredibly abusive. He allegedly raped her. He coerced her into all sorts of behavior. There was a lot of drugs that she was plied with. Again, that's the allegations.
Yes, allegedly he would insist on these evenings called freak-offs that he made, allegedly Cassie organized all the logistics for, where male sex workers would be hired to hotel rooms and Cassie would be allegedly forced to perform sex acts on them whilst Diddy watched, also while on drugs.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It definitely feels like more abuse allegations are going to come out of the woodwork, don't they?
Already on social media, surviving Diddy is trending.
Yep, he is perhaps going to be the next R. Kelly.
What I found interesting was that despite R. Kelly obviously being charged and guilty and a terrible man, he weirdly has quite a big, like, still loyal fan base that defend
him. Yeah, there are some deniers, aren't there?
Big deniers, like with Michael Jackson. But with Diddy, men and women were all saying the same thing, which is they're like, yeah, we've known it for years.
See, the one negative thing I did see, and you always get this, is people asking why she would sue for money and not be pushing for criminal charges.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure what the exact reason there is, but I know that the NYPD have no criminal charges against him at this time. My understanding is that she was seeking damages from lost earnings because he not only coerced her in terms of their relationship, but her career, he had a complete vice grip over. Felt a little bit Kesha.
Dr. Luke.
Yeah. So actually, I think what's brilliant is that it's even just brought it to light and people have argued why now. Well, her NDA has only just expired, so that's why she's actually able to speak on it. Secondly, I think what gave fuel to people's argument that she was, I suppose, money seeking was that the lawsuit was settled literally the day after it was filed. They've come to an agreement for an undisclosed amount of money. But I don't think that that makes her look guilty, or I think him paying her off makes him look way more guilty.
Yeah.
And I can totally see why she wouldn't want to drag herself through the public circus
of
going through those painful allegations in a courtroom.
Which is already deeply traumatic for her and will trigger loads of PTSD.
Exactly.
And yeah, it's never nice for women to be in that situation, as we know.
Yeah.
Women's like sexual history are always raked over in the most like humiliating ways.
Exactly. You can totally see why she wouldn't want that. One allegation I found quite interesting in terms of bolstering her claims as well, when we actually just look back at information that's in the public eye, was the allegation that on several occasions he made her carry his gun in her purse as a kind of coercive thing to make her feel scared and intimidated. And that really reminded me of what went down with him and J-Lo in the 90s.
I totally forgot they dated.
So for those that don't know, P. Diddy and J-Lo dated in the 90s. He was actually a kind of bona fide star at this point, whereas J-Lo was more of a rising star. They were both from the Bronx, which is what I think kind of brought them together initially. They met through work. He worked with her on the If You Had My Love music video.
Right.
And that's the first single off her debut album. So it was very much in the kind of early times. They became an item. It attracted loads of attention in the press. Then they were actually arrested as a couple in 1999.
I did not know this.
Crazy, right? So I did a little bit of sleuthing because I could vaguely remember it and I couldn't remember the exact details. So I went away and had a look, and Paper Magazine used to do this series called Hollyweird, where they would take stock of once known but obscure or forgotten stories about popular celebrities and cult figures, like bit of us. No.
Yes. Sad that they don't still do it.
So they detail exactly what happened. And basically in December 1999, the pair were arrested on a weapons charge following an incident at a New York nightclub. It was a night called Hot Chocolate, and they were there to celebrate the release of a rapper called Shine's soon-to-be-released album, who was P. Diddy, a.k.a. Sean Combs' like protege, and he was signed to Bad Boy Entertainment, which is P. Diddy's label. So around 2:20 in the morning, as J-Lo and Combs were leaving, a champagne bottle in hand, Combs accidentally knocked a drink out of a patron's hand. That essentially ended up in a massive scuttle. We're not quite sure what happens. Reports diverge on whether Combs threw his money at Scar like confetti. But some kind of digs were made around Combs' wealth and money. So I think that that shows how much he is an egotistical person.
Yeah.
The conflict escalated and rounds went off, as in rounds of shots. One allegedly coming from Puffy's gun. Three of the club's patrons injured. One woman was shot in the face. J-Lo and Combs sped away in a 1999 Lincoln Navigator, but they ran a red light and they were pulled over by the police. They were in possession of a stolen 9mm handgun, which was found in the trunk. So yeah, they were both arrested. She was taken to prison. She spent 14 hours in jail. The police said that she was just like crying hysterically the entire time. She eventually got away with it and she wasn't charged, but Sean Combs was charged. I think he was later acquitted. However...
So do we think that he was making J-Lo carry the gun in her purse?
Well, it was in the trunk of the car, so no. But I still think it's a bit dodgy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, she had essentially had to take the rap for his stolen gun in the car, which perhaps may or may not have actually just been fired.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. God, and what about the woman that was shot in the face? I hope she
well, exactly.
Okay.
I mean, I don't even know, but I do think it's pretty interesting. He was later acquitted, as I say, but the fact that she was literally arrested because of him, they broke up in 2001. So people say that that relationship ended immediately after that, really.
Yeah.
That was the kind of breakdown. However, in 2003, she told Vibe that I was in this relationship with Puff where I was totally crying, crazy and going nuts. And it really took my life into a whole tailspin. I mean... So in the relationship, you were totally crying crazy and going nuts and it put your life in a tailspin. Doesn't sound like the healthiest partnership, does it? So she also indicated that he wasn't faithful. So she said, I never caught him, but I just knew. He said he was going to a club for a couple of hours and then he'd never come back that night. She said she obviously didn't want that in her future. So she said, I had to think, do I want to be home with the kids in 10 years, wondering where somebody is at 3 a.m? It's just not a great look for him, that. To me, I am taking this J-Lo... relationship,
yeah,
as kind of literal evidence that the Cassie allegations feel massively real.
I totally agree with you. Do we think that he will be able to come back from this?
It's really tricky because I just don't know whether more stuff's going to come out of the woodwork, like we said. So he had a girl band, for example, called Danity Kane at one time, and several members of that band have posted sort of cryptic things in the last couple of days off the back of Cassie's allegations that really do back up what she's saying. So one allegation that I thought was really interesting as well and kind of, you know, involves another famous person who has also backed it up. So Puff Daddy was so jealous and possessive that he threatened to blow up a man's car. Said man was in fact Kid Cudi, and his car did indeed mysteriously blow up in his driveway. So Kid Cudi has confirmed to the New York Times that, and I quote, in terms of Cassie's allegations, it's all true.
Fucking hell. It's so scary, isn't it? Because... Diddy is so powerful and has so much money.
It's just, yeah, all these hugely powerful men that are massive narcissists that kind of hide in plain sight for decades. You mentioned to me off air that you'd read about him even manipulating male artists in their careers.
Yeah, I've seen that he was inappropriate with Justin Bieber.
Wow. I didn't even know they had a professional relationship.
I think he was like, he was just looking after him when, I mean, I think
he was a kind of mentor.
I think
during Dustin's dark years.
Yeah, I think so. It's very, very disturbing. So I am really hoping other women come out and he can go down properly.
I hope so. I think he has a bad energy, full stop. I've never really liked him.
Thing is, what I worry about was when it's so flash in a pan like this, that allegations came out, then settled the next day, it's very easy for people in the industry to be like, didn't happen. As we know, with a well-known politician, when massive stuff came out about him recently and... none of the papers were allowed to print it for legal reasons. And,
oh, yeah.
And now it's just completely like being swept under the carpet because it was just shut down so quickly.
Yes, I really hope this picks up steam and other women feel empowered to come forward, even though he's not being faced with criminal charges. I hope actually everyone just knowing about it is enough.
Yeah. God, okay.
Right, so in keeping with this week's general topic, looking at crime, punishment, incarceration... I wanted to tell you about this very sweet film that I watched recently called Flora and Son. Have you heard of it?
Yes, because it's got Ahan Eve Hewson in it, Bono's daughter, but also more importantly, the star of Bad Sisters.
I know. So I was literally today years old when I found out that Eve Hewson is Bono's daughter. I hadn't made that connection. Yeah. I didn't realise.
She was in the Cuts Nepo Baby chart.
Guys, if you haven't seen Bad Sisters, you have to watch it.
So
what
good.
I will say though is I think perhaps that's a little bit unfair because I genuinely think that she is where she is because she's a great actress. She's so good.
She's so good.
Eve Houston makes this film. Really? Absolutely makes it. She's brilliant. So she plays single mum Flora, who's at a loss about what to do with her rebellious teenage son, Max. He's like one bad move away from juvie. And I don't know why I'm saying juvie, like we're American.
Juvie. So,
like Young Offenders Institute. And her efforts to keep him out of trouble lead to a beat up acoustic guitar, which she finds in a dumpster, and a washed up LA musician who she does Zoom lessons with. That's Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And essentially harmony for this frayed Dublin family. So it's a musical, but it's a musical more in the way that, say, Daisy Jones and the Six is.
Right.
Which obviously we loved.
We absolutely
like,
loved it.
There aren't just people jumping into song at any given time. It's very much like it just happens to be a film where music is part of it. And so okay. The song is a part of the narrative.
So it doesn't make you want to cringe.
So it doesn't feel like a musical. It's just like, oh, there just so happens to be some songs in it. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And I loved that. I mean, I actually wanted to ask you on this point, do we like musicals?
No.
Okay, that was a quick verdict.
I am in a friendship group who love karaoke and love musicals and love like the soundtracks like The Greatest Showman. Whenever I go on a hen with my uni friends who I deeply love, but also we have very different taste in music and they love their like musical theatre soundtracks.
Okay.
And I don't know any of the words.
So if they love karaoke, do you know where you literally need to go? Shout out for all the Huns who love a bit of singing. Bao Noodle Shop in Shoreditch.
Oh, wow.
So they have, you know, Bao, like the Bao place, like
yes,
BAO.
Love a Bao.
They have opened KTV rooms in their basement. So you hire a room for 2 hours, 14 people, and you can order all the like cocktails and dumplings and whatever that you want while you're in there. And you just do karaoke for 2 hours. We did it for my friend's birthday the other week. You know, I don't usually love that kind of thing.
No.
I loved it. We had the best time. We just basically lined up all of our bangers, like our group songs that we all love and know. And rather than really giving people turns, like there's two mics. And yes, we would like pass them around, but really it was just 14 of us. Screaming at the top of our lungs to every single song.
See, I would quite like that. I don't like being watched.
It was chaos. I'm going to show you a video after. No one was watching. Like, everyone was too busy screaming their own thing.
Yeah, like, okay, no, I like that.
I hate that kind of musical. Like I said, the kind of ones where people just spring into song and dance out of nowhere. So La La Land, I've tried to watch that so many times. Can't.
Hate. Yeah.
Hate. Would never want to watch, like, the film of Les Miserables or something.
No.
Can't think of anything worse.
Anna Karenina, there was a musical version, which I didn't like.
Oh, my God, no. But I do like a musical in the theatre.
See, I hate.
I
musicals
like
in a theatre. Why? You're so not cheesy.
I do like, you know, I loved Wicked, loved Lion King, loved Cats, loved Phantom of the Opera. Like, I have seen a lot of those.
Wow.
Those big West End shows. And I think it was more I loved them when I was a kid. And so it's a nostalgic thing
for me. Yes, I never went to... Well, I went to one musical theatre with my parents. It was West Side Story, and I'd just been dumped.
Oh.
Listeners will know from my last episode.
Oh, was it that?
Yeah.
Dumping.
It was that dumping. So I was so upset.
Okay, so you're just scarred.
I'm scarred. But also I just don't like musicals. Partly, I think, because I don't remember the words for stuff. So I hate things where I'm expected to sing along to.
Yeah. Okay, so on the musical theatre front,
yeah.
Did you know that the Mean Girls musical is coming to London next year?
Yes, I did. Because my friends have already started a group chat about it.
Oh no, have they? Because you know it's being like derided as like universally lame.
Oh no,
yes,
is it?
Sadly. Well, do you know what they've done? So basically the musical has also been made into a film, which is coming out soon. So there's a musical film for which the trailer has dropped. Guys, pause now, go away and watch.
Wait,
it.
Wait, sorry, there's a film of the musical, yes. Mean Girls, but we already have a Mean Girls film.
Yeah, I know. How weird is that? They're doing a reboot with the same story. It's not even like, you know, moving on from the narrative that it was. It's the same thing. Katie Heron, it's all done by Tina Fey again. She's going to be in it playing the teacher again.
As in the musical theatre version. Which
so she's not going to be on stage in London, but she's in the film. The musical film.
Oh,
of
sorry.
Mean Girls.
Right, yeah. Okay.
So basically, there's two musical Mean Girls.
There's two.
Yes, no, I am saying that right. It's a tongue twister. There are two Mean Girls musicals coming out. One in theatre. There's already one in theatre. Yeah. It's in the US and it's coming to the UK next year, to London. There's also a Mean Girls musical that's coming out as a film.
Get some new ideas, guys.
Isn't it? I'm sorry. And do you know it's being literally sold as like, this isn't your mom's Mean Girls. I'm sorry,
well, who is
we're
it?
Not that old.
What do you mean? Oh, I see.
As in like, so they're obviously trying to target a new kind of Gen Z audience rather than people like ours who actually saw the film when it came out at the time.
Oh my God, so they're seeing us as the mums?
Yes.
That is deeply insulting.
Isn't it?
Fun fact for you about Rachel McAdams.
Always. Go.
She is probably the nicest celebrity I've ever met. Basically, we were at St. Paul's Cathedral for the Doctor Strange.
Oh, I do remember that. Yeah, yeah.
For
the first work event together.
Yeah, it was a Doctor Strange premiere where also, fun fact, Benedict Cumberbatch was such a massive tosser.
Okay, guys, so hopefully you already know this, but here at Straight Up, we actually reach out to every single sponsor that we work with all ourselves, meaning that when you hear a recommendation like this one, we have cherry-picked the brand based on products that we already use and really, really want to share with you all. Also with a discount code, of course.
Yeah, we would never advertise something that we don't already love. And Adaptogenic Coffee has been perhaps our favorite discovery of the past year. It took trying a few different brands, but since we found London Nootropics, we've never looked back. They're three different very tasty blends, all boost brain health while actively and noticeably helping with focus, reducing anxiety, boosting energy, memory, and more.
So just to explain adaptogens and nootropics a little bit, they are natural ingredients like medicinal mushrooms that really improve mental well-being and change how you feel when you consume them. London Nootropics Zen Blend, for example, which is their most balancing blend, contains award-winning ashwagandha in the highest concentration, as well as premium CBD. It is the absolute dream for when you're feeling stressed. The adaptogens in all the blends, actually, by the way, as well, counteract the usual jitters and crashes that you might get from regular coffee. Zen, though, is particularly soothing. I always get really quite anxious the morning after drinking alcohol, but a sachet of Zen now sorts me right out.
It really does make you feel so alert, calm, and focused. I have to say, I was a bit skeptical before actually trying adaptogens myself, but now I cannot imagine starting the morning without a cup of London Nootropics Adaptogenic Coffee. We can't wait to hear what you all think as well. Head to londonnootropics.co.uk and enter the code straight up at the checkout for 20% off. That's straight up, all one word, no caps.
So back to Flora and Son. You can watch it on Apple TV. It came out about a month ago and it's actually going to have a limited release in cinemas as well. And it's quite a sweet one to go and see in the cinema. Like, it would be quite a cute one to go and see with like a family member or something. The one thing I found, I guess, slightly problematic about it, and we're going to get into this with our criminal justice discussion today, is that, this is a slight spoiler, so if you're going to watch the film, pause now. Her son Max does end up going to the Young Offenders Institute, and I found it a laughably unrealistic depiction of what prison is really like, given the book that I have just read called Criminal by Angela Kerwin, who's a former social worker who worked in prisons for over a decade, and she gives a very realistic insight into the prison system. I know you're going to talk a little bit about time.
Yes. What did you realise was unrealistic about the juvenile detention system?
So for one, the judge allows him to bring his music equipment into the prison, and it's like, come on, that would never happen. They're not going to give some people the opportunity to bring a load of their tech from home. He basically just like makes beats in his room, which he also isn't sharing a room. I mean, I can't speak to young offenders, so if anyone does have an understanding of the prison estate, do let us know. But I know, obviously, in adult prison for men, like, you're sharing a room, it's two per room, you're not on your own.
Yeah.
And this, the kid is 13 and he's actually using it as almost like, it looks very much like those ridiculous accusations that you get, like a holiday camp, like he's gone to like go and be rehabilitated and have fun with his music and just get back into his creative thing that drives him. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but anyone that has a vague understanding of the reality of the criminal justice system knows that the idea of a holiday camp, which is pushed so much by the tabloids, really couldn't be further from the reality.
Interesting. Yeah, although I guess in a utopian mindset, I would have thought that giving kids like hobbies and allowing them to like follow passions.
Oh no, that's deeply important for rehabilitation.
Yeah.
That's literally vital. So one of the points Angela Kerwin even makes in her book about this kind of tabloid depiction of monsters who we don't want to have an easy ride in these holiday camps is when there's been a narrative that people shouldn't have mobile phones in prison. Well, actually, in that scenario, they're young offenders, and the data shows that ties to your community massively reduce your chance of reoffending. So having young people who are in prison be able to communicate with their families through a mobile phone is actually massively beneficial to their actual rehabilitation.
Yeah.
Yet the papers present it as if it's some kind of soft touch.
That's interesting, babe. I, on that theme, have just seen the second season of Time. Did you watch the first season?
Yeah, so I did see the first few episodes, I think it was. I purposely haven't watched the second season, though, because I want you to tell me all about it.
Yes, so no spoilers. If there are a few spoilers, then I'll warn you so that you can skip. Basically, season one, it's written by Jimmy McGovern, who's brilliant. Season one featured Sean Bean as a teacher who killed a cyclist while drink driving and is in jail. And it's all about forgiveness and redemption and his like obsession with being forgiven by the family of the cyclist who died.
Yeah, one of the quotes that has stayed with me forever since watching that is his mother, when she comes to see him, so he's doing 4 years, and his parents come in and see him, and she says to him, just remember, you're in here as punishment, not for punishment, because he's beating himself so much with the guilt.
Yes.
Of what he's done.
But season two is featured in a women's prison, and I actually way preferred it. I mean, I thought they were both brilliant, but I thought this was like standout. I thought it was so, so good. So it's about these three women, Orla, Abby, and Kelsey, Bella Ramsey,
yeah,
is Kelsey.
I love her so much.
She is, she's definitely going to win a BAFTA for this. She plays a young heroin addict who falls pregnant. So then there's this woman, Abby, who is a middle-class woman who is serving life for an unspeakable crime. I'm not going to say what it is because it actually is a spoiler because you don't find out until later in the episode, but it's a crime that the other women in the prison feel is so heinous that they try and take matters into their own hands.
Yeah.
And then Orla is played by Jodie Whittaker, former Doctor Who, as a working class mother with three children who is put inside for what she calls fiddling the lecky, i.e. like fiddling with the electricity because she can't afford to pay her bills. And what is just so moving about the whole thing is just how awful it is, particularly with Orla, for her to be in prison for such a minor non-violent crime. Her kids get put in foster care. Socially. It breaks up the whole family. One of the kids won't speak to her. And then she becomes more violent as a result. And I think this is one thing that I'm sure it says in your book, but like minor criminals who are in for minor offences who are then rubbing up against criminals who are then for very violent offences actually become more violent.
Yeah, yeah. You become a more hardened criminal
exactly.
from spending time in prison than if you hadn't at all. And if you'd been on a community order or something, that would actually be more rehabilitative than locking you in jail. It's super crazy. You know, in Britain, there are 82,000 people in prison at any one time. That's men, women, children. 69% of those didn't commit a violent crime.
That's insane.
So I'm actually working with this really incredible guy at the moment who had really suffered with alcoholism. And during his rock bottom, he went to jail twice. And he said to me that time is the most accurate depiction of prison that he's ever seen. That it really does get to the crux of what it's really like. And he actually mentioned, so I've not seen it, but he did mention that story to me because it's indicative of the cyclical nature of, I guess, almost inherited trauma. Like her kids, because they've been farmed off to social care, they are now so much more likely to go to prison. So I don't know if you know about the care to prison pipeline, but one quarter, so 25% of the people in prison were in care.
Yes.
So they've come from deeply troubled, unstable family backgrounds. And by putting kids in care, you're actually destabilizing them even further. I mean, a point that Angela Cohen makes in her book is that, again, contrary to popular opinion and the way that the papers would have it, social workers aren't sort of trigger happy people so ready to take kids away from their parents. It's actually like a last step. Like kids are actually left in really quite dark, abusive, drug and alcohol riddled homes. And it's another trauma to separate a child from their parents. So you only do it if you really have to. So the thing that stuck with me from what you'd mentioned was that apparently, is this right? My colleague told me she's given a tent to live in.
Yes.
And yet we've had fucking Suella Varaman saying it's a lifestyle choice. The government are literally giving people tents to live in.
Yeah. And she says, is this a joke?
Yeah.
And the officer is like, I'm so sorry, but no. I mean, the officer is clearly mortified as well. So I've read a 2021 report from UK and crime justice consultancy Crest Advisory, which was tracking the impact of imprisonment of mothers on them and their children and the financial cost. And one of the cases that was tracked involved a mother convicted for drug possession with intent to supply. This led to her child being placed in care, which as you say, puts the kid at huge risk of exploitation, suicide and school exclusion.
But
the
abuse.
And abuse. And the cost of imprisoning the mother and providing care for the child while she was incarcerated was 265,000 quid.
Yeah, the amount of money we spend is honestly wild. We have the highest incarceration rate in the whole of Western Europe. So that's literally like all of Europe apart from Russia, which is obviously massive and also pretty problematic place. And we also have the highest prison bill in Europe. So we spend 3.4 billion a year. And then get this, this is the worst part of it all. We are so warped in our approach to rehabilitation, i.e. there is none. There is no rehabilitation really that's actually meaningful. We spend 18.1 billion a year on reoffending. So the reoffending rate in the UK is 47%. So half the people that go into jail within the first year of they're out, they just do something again.
Well, yeah, Orla in time reoffends immediately because, of course, she's not a criminal. Like she was fiddling the lecky because she couldn't provide
for
her children.
It's people that are in a really difficult... Yeah. Like usually poverty-stricken situations.
Exactly. So she reoffends because, again, she can't support her family.
So one of the stats that shocked me the most from Angela Kerman's book, and honestly, I cannot reiterate enough how brilliant this book is. So it's called Criminal, Real Life Stories of the People Trapped in Our Failing Justice System. And the way Angela Kerman tells it is that each chapter focuses on a topic, i.e. mental health, addiction, when life means life, what about the paedophiles, all the kind of key topics that you might imagine would come up in a discussion around prison. She uses an individual that she met during her time there in 10 years as a social worker to explain that.
Okay.
And so if you're looking at people that have been in care, for example, there's a whole chapter on the pipeline that I've mentioned, care to prison, and she explores why that's the case using a real life person. So it makes it really digestible, and you feel so much empathy for these people because you understand why they are the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing that really shocked me, and it's very relevant to The Woman in Time, is that I had no idea that when you go to prison, you forfeit your right to housing from your local authority. So you are labelled voluntarily homeless if you've been to prison. So when people come out of prison, the local authority that they live within has absolutely no obligation to give them housing.
Whoa.
So how crazy is that? So no wonder people are reoffending immediately. They're homeless.
Yes, well, without... spoiler here, guys, but one of the reasons Ola reoffends is because she's desperately trying to get a deposit for a flat so she can get her kids back out.
Yeah, because she can't get housing. And this is another part of the warped system. And Angela does such a great job at explaining all of these ways in which it's so broken. Whilst we do have these incredible individuals who are trying their best to help people, actually, it's the setup of the system that's so broken. So when you're serving time, you can't apply for benefits until you've finished your sentence. Well, then that means when you come out of prison, not only do you have no housing, you have no benefits, but to apply for your benefits you need housing. And so it's this kind of crazy chicken and egg situation, as you say, where people cannot get back on their feet after they've done time. And I think what's really interesting, I don't know whether you get this from Time, I think you certainly do from season one with Sean Bean, but his character, you know, prison is not full of just purely like bad people. Like, a lot of the people in prison, as mentioned, you know, a quarter of them grew up in care. Lots of people are suffering with very severe mental health issues. There's a lot of addiction, which is, of course, in and of itself a mental health issue. And there's actually a big number of people that have IQs below 80 there. So these are really vulnerable people. And yet we treat them as if they are scum.
Definitely.
Animals, worse than animals.
Jimmy McGovern, who, as I say, wrote the show, actually was quoted saying, because he doesn't believe that people should be in prison unless they're properly dangerous. He says, an awful lot of female inmates are in there because of men. They've been covering up for men. They've been duped into doing the dirty business for men. They've been selling drugs for men, buying drugs for men.
Yeah. It's a lot of coercion. It really is. I think the misperception is that we bang up all the murderers and the paedophiles. Like, yeah, we do, but they make up 12,000 of those 82,000. That's not the majority of people. The majority of people are these vulnerable types that we're talking about. And I think if we had a far more rigorous social care system, a lot of these problems could be avoided.
Yes, and we have a massive, massive capacity issue. There's only like 500 places in prison in UK prisons left for the rest of the year.
Yeah, and yet we've always had this policy now for the last like 20 years in Britain from both Conservative and Labour governments to be extremely tough on crime and punishment, because that's what wins votes. And we have this quite old-fashioned view in this country here in the UK that like we need to make people pay for what they've done. We don't really look at the rehabilitative side of it. And actually... everyone should care because it affects all of us. All of our tax money is spent on this. And it's not a lack of money in the system. As I say, they're spending 18.1 billion on reoffension. Like, that money could be saved if you actually rehabilitated people properly and got them on their feet and helped them to get out of poverty and also perhaps be helped with severe mental illness.
Yeah, so when I did some work with a podcast, which is actually really good, I really recommend it, called Banged Up, which it's two former inmates. One, Rob Morrison, who was an entrepreneur that got done for fraud, and one, Michael Botang, a footballer who got done for match fixing, and their prison officer, Claire Salamer. So Claire kind of like is the host and asked some different questions about their time in prison from season one. And both of them talk about how like spending 23 hours in your cell.
Oh my God, it's awful. And the reason people are spending so much time in their cells is because of a lack of staffing. I mean, the National Audit Office, they've actually said they can draw no link between increased incarceration and reduction of crime. So locking people up doesn't work. Like, we have the data. Everyone that knows about it knows. As Angela Carnwen puts it, unless we come into contact with the system ourselves, we can keep believing it works.
So we need to really focus on increasing community sentences.
Oh, 100%. They work. They're far more effective.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, I think a huge issue is treating drugs and addiction as the public health issue they are and not a criminal issue. So for example, in Portugal, where of course drugs are decriminalized, if you're a drug user and you're caught, you go up in front of a panel as part of your sentencing, I suppose you'd call it, but you go in front of a psychiatrist, a lawyer and a social worker, and they decide what's best for you. And you usually will be sent into like rehabilitation. You know, there's no point of locking people up when they have severe dependencies. Like, you know, for example, if you're a heroin addict and you go to prison, you're on a methadone script for the whole time that you're there. So you're not being made clean. Like, you're going to come out of prison and you're either going to need to keep up with your methadone or you're just going to need to go and score some heroin.
Yeah.
So we're keeping people drugged. And I think there's this misperception that people dry out when they're in prison. Well, in fact, a third of inmates think it's easier to find drugs than in prison than they do on the out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's spice is obviously a massive issue in prisons.
Yeah, I mean, the character Kelsey is able to get heroin within like 2 seconds. I mean, she sneaks heroin into the prison. She's like getting high within like 2 seconds of her being in her cell.
Yeah, I think the drug piece is really vital because actually if we decriminalize drugs in that way and we weren't locking people up because of addiction and because of drug-related crime, we would halve the number of people in prisons immediately. So all of the overcrowding, all of the overspending, you know, again, being a kind of wider social issue that impacts us all, it would be in everyone's benefit. But for some reason, it's not a popular viewpoint. Do you know anyone that's been to prison?
I do know a few people, actually. Interestingly, like very much like across the class divide, quite a few people that I went to uni with.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Angela Kerman says in her book. Again, when you actually speak to people, even though it's a taboo subject, when you do a bit of digging, you find most people have been touched in some way by some experience of the criminal justice system.
And so do you?
Well, yeah, I do. So like one of my cousins actually went to prison like when I was a kid, which only for a short period of time, but I didn't know about it then. Again, I think it was drug related. My ex-boyfriend went to prison. And then there was a guy at my uni. Do you remember how there was loads of protests about them changing the university fees?
Yeah.
So he was part of those student protests and he chucked a placard and it hit someone and he got done for it. Like he went to jail for that.
Oh, God.
So yeah, as you say, it's people from all sorts of walks of life.
Definitely,
and I think there's a misperception about who's really there.
Well, that was what was so interesting about Banged Up, which again, I really urge everyone to listen to, was listening to Rob and Michael, who have had such different experiences. One being like middle class from Wandsworth, that kind of lad, one of the like into rugby. And then the other one being a black working class footballer. They were cellmates, sorry. That's why they started the podcast.
Because they were cellmates.
Yeah. And I think they met at Wandsworth Prison. And so they're just like very different experiences of what led them there and then how prison
changed
things. Was just and guided by this amazing female prison lawyer. It's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, so in this book, Criminal, while it's an incredibly depressing read in a lot of ways, you don't come away from it feeling entirely despondent because of the individuals that are working in these systems desperately trying to help and change people. I did think Stephen Graham's character in the first season of Time came across quite well. We love a bit of Stephen Graham. He plays the screw.
Yeah.
So the prison officer.
He's so good. Cathers, we have many pet peeves that unite us, but I must say one of the most notable has got to be our misophonia, which, as we've recently discovered, is the term used to describe a negative emotional reaction to common sounds.
Oh my God, babe, nothing enrages us quite like the sound of someone frothing at their desk or tapping away violently on their keyboard. For me, as someone that struggles with ADHD, distracting sounds are honestly such an issue when I'm trying to work. I actually can't cope.
Of course, which is why we're such big fans of the tiny, comfy and super unobtrusive Karma earbuds from our brilliant podcast sponsor, Flare Audio. Cathers, how do they work? Take it away.
Well, huns, our ears are shaped like shells, so the sound we receive is always distorted at about 20%. Most people's brains filter that out, but if, like me and Elle's, yours needs a little bit of a helping hand, then the Karma earbuds are just perfect.
Such an upgrade, I have to say, from my noise-cancelling headphones, which are very antisocial when you're in the office and a colleague's trying to talk to you and block you off from sounds you actually really need to hear. Don't just take our word for it either, guys. They've sold 2 million pairs since the launch of lockdown, and they even do mini versions for kids and a new version called Karma Soft, which is an extra soft option for those with more sensitive ears.
And the extra, extra good news is that Flare Audio has 20% off site-wide right now. It's for Black Friday, so go to flareaudio.com to snap up your Karma earbuds for just $15.96 instead of the usual $19.95.
Thank you so much to Flare. Interestingly, and I would love to know once you've watched season two whether you agree with this. We'll come back to it. But Camilla Long, who's the Times, writes TV reviews The Times, said it was completely caricaturing the female experience, that female characters slip away from Jimmy McGovern. She says, we watched as all three main characters slowly dissolved into a single female stereotype, the angry mad woman defined entirely by her children. Bodily functions also tell a lot of the story, all as horror at prison is shown by her getting a huge period, then panicking over sanitary towels.
But like, that's part of the horror of being in prison for a woman.
She says, a woman really just a collection of tears, sweat and blood. Don't we deserve more?
I mean, I usually always disagree with Camilla Long, so having even not seen it, I'm going to assume that I disagree with her.
I very much did disagree with her. I think actually having a period in prison and not having sanitary towels is. That just shows that like women aren't properly catered for.
And it's about the dehumanization of people. Like that's the problem with jail. It takes away all of your dignity.
Exactly. And that is crucial.
And there is such a different system. So in Angela Kerwin's book, she looks at the Copenhagen system, and that is like what we would consider a utopia, but actually it works brilliantly. It's a proper rehabilitative system. They spend less money than us in the long run. They have no reoffending, really. They treat people with proper respect. For example, you don't share a room, you have your own room. Mm. And when she speaks to a guy there, he's like, I don't think I could have done the work that I needed to do with sharing a room with someone, especially someone who's very vulnerable and probably very mentally ill. Like that's a lot. How are you possibly going to get back on a right track? Like just as a reference in terms of just how much people are suffering, 11,000 inmates were recorded to have self-harmed from 2020 to 2021. And there's no psychiatric infrastructure for them. Like you've literally got to be like about to kill someone else or kill yourself to actually be taken seriously. So apparently it's so common for guys to swallow bleach, to hurt themselves in all these different ways that are partly a cry for attention because they are deemed that way by the prison, which actually they're people that are so unwell that everyone's almost like tired of them if they're not at the point of actual grievous harm.
That's so, yeah. In Time, one of the characters, the only way that she can speak to someone high up enough in the prison about her kids going foster care is to slash her wrists.
Yeah, and Angela Kerwin mentions it to the guy that she's looking around the Copenhagen prison with, so one of the main prison officers there, and she says to him, like, but what do you do when inmates hurt themselves? And he looks at her like she's actually crazy and is like, well, then they'd be in a psychiatric hospital, not prison.
I know someone who was a prison nurse for a long time, and some of the stuff they saw was just absolutely harrowing.
I bet.
You have to be of incredibly strong stuff too.
Yeah, the mental health impact on staff, I think, is not really considered.
Like, it's not, no.
For you to spend your days locked up there in that bleak environment with people that have been completely disregarded by the system, by society. I think an interesting point that she makes is, how can we expect these people to be reintroduced to society, to the community, when they never had a community to start with? So why do we then suddenly expect them to be like these productive, great members of society when we've treated them like animals, locked them up? They've gone, I mean, I cannot believe on the juvenile detention, young offenders point, as mentioned with Max in Florence, and he's 13, he's going to prison. But can you believe that we send a 12-year-old to prison? Like, that is just crazy.
That is absolutely crazy. Yeah, I don't know what you can learn from. You're still growing, so how can you possibly even understand what punishment
is
in
like
that way?
Surely there's a more appropriate way to deal with a misbehaving 12-year-old than locking them up, because then they're probably going to spend the rest of their lives in and out of prison and never actually have a meaningful life outside of incarceration.
Yes, I think if you're going to see prison in the best possible light as a way, as a time to reflect and rehabilitate, which sadly, of course, it doesn't provide, but you can't do that whilst you're still mentally growing, like when you're still a child.
How are you going to reflect at 12 if you've had a very difficult childhood?
You can't.
And been exposed to all sorts of trauma, and then you basically reenact that onto other people. Well, you need like proper therapy and all the rest of it. It's really sad. I mean, Angela Kerwin's argument, and I have to say I agree with it, because it's very much a kind of tale like This Is Going to Hurt, Adam McKay, where he basically becomes completely disillusioned with the NHS to the point where it's going to like massively impact his own mental well-being if he continues. Angela Kerwin gets the same point. So after 10 plus years in prisons, spending every single day of her working life in men's prisons, she just realizes there's nothing she can do, nothing more. The whole system is so broken. There's no amount of things that individuals can really achieve without the whole structural organization
I think
being changed.
As you touched upon with Stephen Graham's character, I think what's really good about Time season 1 and 2 is there are moments where you can really, that it really interrogates how the staff feel and their responsibility. There's lots of inmates saying, you horrible, horrible, callous bitch, how can you possibly let this happen to me and stop me from seeing my children? And I think what's really good about Time is it really humanizes the staff and it shows them how much like they care.
Yeah. And it's most people do actually go into that line of work from some place of caring.
And because they might, and I think this is also really explored like through the chaplain's character, for instance, they have some dark stuff of their own. A lot of that's why they're there, because they've suffered some shit.
And they have empathy for people in prison. It's really awful, because I think if we could treat the staff better, the whole system would be different. Whereas we have people that are underpaid, all the prisons are understaffed, as you touched on earlier. People are locked up 23 hours a day because there just isn't the actual number of people to be able to have all the doors open and things like that. It's just dangerous.
Definitely. That's what happens in time as well. Two incidents happen at the same time and there literally isn't enough staff to deal with both of them.
Yeah, you have to make a call.
So one of them gets severely injured.
Yeah, so Angela Kerwin's, I guess, closing argument is that very sadly, there is almost a generation of people who with whom can only be helped so much. And that really, if we actually want to properly change the system, we need to get in there with children. And so it's targeting vulnerable children who are already exposed to violence, who might be going into the care system, who might be around heavy addiction, that kind of lifestyle that is ripe for
absolutely
a criminal lifestyle later on. We need to get in there and work with those kids. And that's really the only way that we're going to stop this awful, intergenerational cycle. You're obviously way more likely to go to prison if one of your parents has been, all that kind of thing.
Where did you, how did you know of the book, babe? Who recommended it to you?
So Daniel Fincham, the founder of Recovolution, as I mentioned, a former alcoholic who has been in prison himself. He recommended it to me. But it was fun fact, and I only found out about this after, also recommended by former guest of the podcast, Alistair Campbell. So he's talked about it on Rest of Politics before.
Oh, has he?
Yeah. Highly recommend it, guys. Please do go and order a copy of this book. As I say, it isn't that depressing. It's actually really galvanizing. I think maybe my favorite thing about the whole book is that the last chapter, it's an appendix, is what can I do? And I love that because I think that's so important. So I actually might say now.
Oh, yes, let's give us some positive,
because I think it's really important that we feel empowered to be able to do something about this, even if we're not actually in the prison state as employees.
Very good idea.
So for one, very simply, you can subscribe to Inside Time, which is the national prison newspaper.
Okay.
You can donate.
Sorry, and subscribing to Inside Time is good because
it'll give you an honest look. So from the inmates' points of view to the current conditions, the issues behind the walls.
That actually reminds me, there's a Esquire have a columnist who is inside.
Oh, do they? Oh,
American Esquire. Yeah, and he's a good writer.
You can donate to the Samaritans, who train up inmates as listeners and save more lives than we could ever count every single year. So that's a really big point that she makes in the book that I had no idea, as we say, because it's so understaffed. Largely, it's inmates looking after each other. It's inmates who really provide that actual support and an ear that other inmates, vulnerable but in particular, need. So listeners, the Samaritans train them. They'll sit up all night with someone that's suicidal and talk to them. And that's a big even pressure on them. Mm. You know, they're inmates themselves, but without those people, there would be far more self-harm and suicide in prisons. So that's a really simple and easy way you can support.
Yes, yeah.
You can look into events at the Howard League for penal reform. So they do panel discussions, that kind of thing. I would say, though, most practical. So one, sounds simple, but just give some money to a homeless person without judgment.
Yeah.
So 280,000 homeless people in the UK at any one time, and a quarter of people that come out of jail are released into homelessness. So actually, just think about it, as Angela puts it, you're not Henry VIII. There aren't worthy and unworthy poor. These are just people sleeping rough who can choose to spend your change in the way that aids their survival in that moment.
Do you know what? I was listening to a recent Restless Politics episode, and Alistair Campbell, who's clearly very interested in prison reform, was talking about a recent study in Canada where lots of homeless people were given £4,000 each, and almost all of them put that into getting accommodation and getting a job, and very, very few of them spent it on drugs or alcohol, which is just so positive.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to do.
And it's so, so true.
Yeah.
You're getting away from the fear-mongering headlines of the tabloids and looking at the actual reality. I mean, one that really spoke to me, and I've already emailed them actually, haven't heard back yet, but is volunteering with the Shannon Trust. So they're an organization that goes behind the walls and supports people in prison to learn to read.
How do you spell that?
Shannon,
The
Shannon Trust, so S-H-A-N-N-O-N. So one thing you can do, I had thought about this as well, is you can sign up for Meet at the Gate volunteering opportunities in your area.
Okay.
So you can sign up to visit an individual in custody, and then you go through the gate with him or her on their first day back out into the community.
Oh, amazing.
So it kind of keeps them on track on their first day and they don't feel so overwhelmed and scared because they have someone with them that can, I guess, help them to go and sort out, get all their ducks in a row in whatever way that they need to. I mean, I will just say this very quickly, but I think testament to how broken the system is that the police absolutely have no faith in the rehabilitative power of prison, because there's this thing called gate arrests, which I'd never heard of until I read this book, where the police wait outside prison, and when someone's coming out on their day out, they arrest them at the gates and take them straight back. Whereas actually they could just add their charge when they're in there, if you know what I mean. They could add that sentence to their sentence while they're still in jail, and they choose tactically not to do it then and to arrest them. How fucked up is that, that they're doing that to people as well?
Just, are they doing that out of sheer sadism?
So apparently quite a bit of it is to do with just keeping people off the streets for a bit longer. So if you have people that are like a nuisance. So again, really that kind of thing should be used for incredibly like violent inmates. No, it's used for people that are a nuisance to the police and they CBA to like deal with them. So they just lock them up back inside, get them away for as long as possible.
But why can't, as you say, they be added to their sentence whilst they're already inside? Why do they have to let them taste freedom and then not?
Yeah, because you may get a slightly shorter sentence if you're being charged with like multiple crimes at once. So it's a way of ensuring they're in prison for as long as possible.
I see.
Which would suggest that they don't think that prison is rehabilitative. Because if it was, people would come out and then be able to be reintegrated into their communities. The police wouldn't want to lock them up again instantly.
It's actually ridiculous.
Yeah, so I think they are the main things you could do. Also, you know, there are a lot of businesses that actually work with formerly incarcerated people. So I don't know if you knew this, but someone like Timpson, you know, the shoe repair and locksmith retailer.
Oh, yes, which I always use.
They are brilliant, you know. They do loads to support ex-prisoners. So do Combat to Coffee.
Oh, yes. They sponsored Banged Up, actually, I think.
Yeah, so there are real practical ways in which you can get involved with this. You don't need to feel totally despondent.
I'm also sure that, is it a prison in Brixton? They have, because prison radio is such a big thing.
Yeah, they have. Music. Yeah.
I'm sure that they release an album, some of the inmates.
There is. There's a radio show that comes from a prison. Oh, okay. I have one more stat for you on the horrific nature of British jails, just to put into context how bad we are. Dutch courts decided not to extradite a man back from their prisons to HMP Liverpool because they didn't think that his human rights would be respected. The conditions in HMP Liverpool were so substandard that it contradicts the Geneva Convention, and they wouldn't be able to send someone there. How bad is that?
That's actually disgusting. But, well, Cathus, I'm really glad that you gave us constructive things to do. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think. Me too. So you don't just feel powerless in the face of all this like hideousness.
Exactly.
And do buy a copy of Criminal. Honestly, I've literally just scratched the surface. It is genuinely, and I have to be careful here because I realise I say it a lot on the podcast. I use a lot of hyperbole and I'll be like, it's the best book I've ever read. But genuinely, I ripped through this in a day. It is by far the best piece of nonfiction that I've read in the last couple of years. And
crikey.
I'm so passionate about other people reading this book.
I saw that it was blurbed by Secret Barrister, which I've always wanted to read The Diary of the Secret Barrister.
Oh, I haven't read it.
I haven't read it either. No, I really want to.
Well, that will be a...
Maybe a next time.
Upcoming episode.
Hans, we have the best news for those of you based in London. Okay, how would you like to go to the best fitness classes in the capital for free? Yep, you heard me right, without spending a penny.
It's all so exciting, and it's thanks to our amazing partner Yonder, which, as regular listeners will know, is this incredible lifestyle credit card that allows you to earn points for every pound you spend that you can then redeem at a selection of lifestyle experiences across the city, so from restaurants and bars to shops, hotels, gyms and more.
So what's really fun is that the reward partners change each month, so loads to choose from. This month, they've partnered with boxing club Cobox, which describes itself as where Fight Club meets nightclub. And then there's Boom Cycle, which is apparently a party on a bike. Cathers, that sounds like a bit of us.
And actually, it's a fab thing to do for when you want to swap the pub for something just a little bit more wholesome, but still hang out. So I am defo up for that.
Also, guys, the point system is so good that the other night I went to 45 German Street, one of my favorite restaurants, and I used my points with my boyfriend to get the entire £175 meal for free. Also, guys, good to know, the £15 monthly Yonder card fee includes comprehensive travel insurance. So compared to other credit cards on the market, it feels well worth the money.
Thank you so much to our amazing partner Yonder. Get your first month free and 10,000 points when you join, then it's £15 a month thereafter. Please do make sure you borrow responsibly. T's and C's apply. Rep 66.7% APR variable.
So, to finish, Dearest Kath, would you like to hear about Pete Doherty?
Because I've very much been enjoying the TikTok doing the rounds from his documentary where Louis Theroux lulls his baby to sleep.
Yes. And also, I watched the whole thing. It's so good. Go and watch it. It's on BBC. They like get a dip in the sea together and like they wrestle together in the foam.
Okay. So sorry, I have not actually seen it. So it's passed me by a little bit in terms of the structure of the documentary. Is it a Louis Theroux documentary? Is it one of his interviews?
It's one of his interviews. Yeah. So he's done Rita Ora, he's done Stormzy. I think this is his best
Catherine Ryan.
This is definitely his best one. So the reason why everyone's talking about Pete Doherty this year is he is releasing a new album in January with the Libertines. And he headlined Secret Garden Festival. Like, he's getting back on the scene. He's been 3 years sober. He's doing interviews again. The Telegraph, I organized an interview with him a few months ago, which was as chaotic as you would expect, knowing Pete Doherty. He doesn't have a PR. He doesn't have a publicist. So like it was, Helen, the journalist, was just like given his mobile. She called him. He was like, what interview? I don't have an interview. I'm going to the airport, love.
Yeah, and he lives in France.
Yes.
He?
Yeah. And he was going back on the plane. And so he just like hung up on her. And and then eventually I had to get back in contact. But then it wasn't through a PR. So I had to like speak to the festival PR, who had to like call the manager. And the manager was like, oh, for God's sake, yes, he does know about this interview. Anyway, it's a massive shit show. Eventually we did get him on the phone. And he was very clever and funny and like seemed like he was in a really good place. But that was before the Channel 4 documentary came out in September called Pete Doherty, Who Killed My Son. So a few months after we had this quite joyous interview with Pete Doherty, where he seemed to be on the mend and sober and living La Vida Loca with his new wife in France, this documentary, Channel 4 documentary, came out called Pete Doherty, Who Killed My Son. And suddenly the mood around Pete Doherty changed.
Yeah. So what was that documentary about? I never watched it.
So it's really good. It is fronted by a woman called Sheila Blanco, who is the mother of Mark Blanco, who is a 30-year-old Cambridge graduate aspiring actor who, on the 3rd of December 2006, died after having been at a party with Pete Doherty and his entourage. And it's still an open case. Wow. And Sheila Blanco is...
How have I not heard about this?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Sheila Blanco is insisting that the police bungled the investigation, that they were bedazzled by Pete's celebrity. She suggests that Pete knows, that his entourage knew what happened.
And no one to this day knows what happened in that flat.
No, so the police, the main detective thought, ruled it a suicide.
Why were they confident there was a murder?
So the police think it was suicide, but Mark Blanco's mother is sure that there was foul play and that it was a murder. So this is what happened on the night. It's very disturbing. It's unclear how he knew Pete Doherty, but basically Pete Doherty's literary agent, Paul Roundhill, had a flat in Whitechapel where essentially he, Pete Doherty, Kate Moss, that whole like creative, like cokey set would come and do drugs.
Right.
It was like a creative crack den. And they would like write poetry together and very strange things, like Paul Roundhill and Pete Doherty would paint in each other's blood.
Oh my God.
They had a very violent relationship. They would film each other being violent together. And on that night, they were all clearly very high. And Mark Blanco came around, apparently very drunk, with an armful of posters for his new play called Death of an Anarchist, which is about a man who falls to his death from the window of a police station. What is really disturbing about that is that Mark Blanco was then found dead after apparently falling from the first floor, i.e. Paul Roundhill's flat.
Oh my God, that is like so creepily like prophetic and weird. What? Oh, I don't like it.
So there is footage of Mark Blanco's body falling from that window, i.e. Paul Roundhill's flat. There is also footage of Pete Doherty running past the dead body.
In the street,
and it's shown in the documentary.
That's dodgy.
Yeah, Pete was questioned.
He was trying to flee the scene.
Yeah. So Pete has since said in the Louis Theroux documentary, he actually talks about it and it's really moving, but well, depending on whether you believe him or not, but he says, I was just so fucking scared I was going to get nicked for possession of drugs and he'd just been out of prison. So that's why he ran away. But interestingly, Pete's bodyguard, Johnny Headlock, 3 weeks after Mark's death, confessed to the murder, only to then retract it, saying he was high on heavy coke and the police released him without charge.
As in high on heavy coke when he made the statement that he did it?
Yeah.
Right.
Really odd. So Paul Roundhill, who's still knocking around uploading like weird pictures of the libertines on his Instagram. I actually reached out to him for an interview, but I think legally he probably can't even say anything. But at the time, he said that Mark Blanco was very drunk and quite violent, and that he kept having skirmishes with like Pete, with the bodyguard, with Paul Roundhill, and that eventually Roundhill dragged Mark Blanco out of the flat by his coat because he wouldn't leave and he was being aggressive. Then a girl who left the party found Mark Blanco unconscious and covered in blood on the pavement as she left the party.
But didn't you say that there was footage of him coming out of the window?
Yes. So that's there's also...
So there's discrepancies in the story. There's loads... They can't have kicked him out of the party out the front door if he
exactly.
went out.
So yeah.
There's evidence
exactly.
that he
So Paul Roundhill saying that he dragged Mark Blanco out of the flat doesn't make sense with the CCTV footage of what appears
him
to be
him not
Mark...
leaving the flat that yeah. way. Yeah.
And like... It just doesn't make any sense. It's
God,
just
that's really suspect, isn't it?
It's really suspect. So, and also what the mum, do go and watch the documentary because it's really interesting, but the mum says that there was something very strange going on with the way the police looked at each other with a kind of smirk, like they knew something I didn't. She also says she went to the scene of the crime the very next day and there was like evidence on the floor that the police had just like not picked up. Like Mark's glasses were on the ground by the flat. She was like, I can't believe the police hadn't seen it in the 37 hours that it had been there. And the officer said, you can have it as a keepsake instead of like taking it
evidence.
As evidence. Yeah,
it might have fingerprints.
Exactly. Or like be obviously having dropped. Like you could probably analyze the lens to see if it's like dropped from a height. And then also she said that there was something on the stairs that looked like blood. And the police was like, no dried blood goes sticky, so it can't be blood. And the mum was like, that definitely looks like blood on the stairs.
But also like test it.
Like what?
Surely you would make it into a proper crime scene.
So yeah, the implication from the documentary is very much that they were just like star fucking Pete. And didn't want to charge someone who was that
God.
Much. Because like, remember in 2006, like he was dating Kate Moss. They were like huge deal. Like,
and the libertines were massive.
Massive. Anyway, so that documentary came out and everyone's like, fucking hell. Like, why has Pete not spoken about this? And why isn't he like cooperating with the investigation? And like, it's just super shady.
And like, why
has he
moved to France? Because now that feels dodgy that he's moved abroad. And
yeah. And however... The Louis Theroux documentary, I would say, is actually proof that the celebrity interview can actually be really good PR for the celebrity involved if they do allow complete access. I mean, it's like if there was a PR, he doesn't have a PR, as I just said. Had he had a PR, he would not have done this Louis Theroux documentary because he just answers anything. Like he probably legally shouldn't even be talking about this, but he just like properly opens up and it's... really, really compelling and so good. And I mean, I feel like my thoughts were he definitely didn't do it, but he probably knows more than he's letting on.
That's what you got from what he says actually on Louis Theroux's interview.
Yes. So what he says is, Mark Blanco wanted me to know about this play he was doing and I was excited about it. But then when I met him, there was a bit of friction between us. I couldn't connect with him at all. Something weird was going on. There was an altercation with Mark Blanco. We all had an altercation with Mark Blanco. There was pushing and there was shoving, childish playground things going on. And then the next thing is he's on the floor and his skull's cracked open.
Oh my God.
And it's just like, okay, but sorry, that's really weird. What do you mean there was suddenly friction?
Like, and also, what do you mean on the floor, in the flat or out of the window?
I think out the window, right. Yeah. And then he goes, at the time, I just saw it as a fucking inconvenience. And that's an awful thing to say because there he is lying there dead on the street and I was more concerned about getting nicked for possession. So, I mean, even that quote, had he had a PR, they would never have let him say that or they would have cut it out.
Yes.
Like, unparalleled access, which really does give you faith in the celebrity interview. Like, it is not dead. And I would actually say that despite it being very revealing and quite sad at times, it actually has helped Pete Doherty's PR post that Channel 4 documentary to help him like
frame him in a more forgiving light.
Yeah. And also you just feel really sorry for him because he's just like a wreck. Like he even says at one point, death is lurking. I'm not going to be able to see my kid grow up because he's just given
because of how much he's damaged his body.
Yeah. He says like Louis says like, oh, you know, you're gonna see her grow up and have her own family. And Pete's like, are you mental? Like, absolutely not. I'll be lucky if I see her first words.
Wow.
Because he's like, things are just rattling. Yeah.
It's really sad, isn't it? Just how kind of warped our perception of addiction is. People that suffer with addiction should be treated with real empathy and they should be treated as though they have a mental health condition.
Yeah. Although I suppose it's there's more layers to it when it comes to like the rock star life, because as Louis says, like, do you feel like you glamorized heroin addiction, like heroin use? And Pete's like, well, not on purpose, but I guess through my lifestyle I did. Yeah. And he actually gets very emotional. It's, there are a couple of times throughout the interview where he like, it's like cameras off, cameras off. One of them is when Louis asks what I would say is quite a simple question. He just says, what would you tell a young man who was thinking of using heroin today? Mm. And Pete's like really angry. And he's like, what kind of a fucking question is that? Like, how dare you ask me that? Yeah.
Well, that is a bit of an insensitive question, because it's not treating addiction as an illness. It's treating it as a choice, which it
isn't. That's true.
People that are struggling with addiction problems are self-medicating something. It's usually all related to childhood trauma or terrible things that you're trying to forget, medicate, erase. You know, people don't become addicted to drugs and alcohol just because they like them, you know? Like, I think that's a really, really important point. You know, we, like most people, have drink, we've tried drugs, we've committed crimes, and yet we aren't locked up because of our issues. And we also haven't become addicts. You know, people don't just think about become a heroin addict and then do it. Like, it's usually a lot more complicated than that.
Yes.
You know, most people can have a drink and not be an alcoholic. But some people's brains are unfortunately wired in such a way that alcohol is poison to them, but it's also incredibly addictive.
Yeah, so true. And I think also, I think he was annoyed because he maybe felt like Louis was suggesting that there would be an answer that existed of him being like, yeah, do the heroin, you know, like as if, I think Pete was annoyed that Louis thought there might be more than one answer.
Well, it is a stupid question because he's in recovery as well. So clearly he's trying to get back to himself.
Well, that's what's really interesting. He says, my body still tingles when I think about it so much that he actually has to take blockers so that if he did start using again, heroin wouldn't have an effect. So he literally has to take a precautionary blocker so that he doesn't, he knows he can't get high.
And actually, a guy that I know, he mentioned a quote from the George Best documentary where someone says, but George, you haven't drunk for a year after a relapse. And he's like, yeah, but I've thought about it every day. And I think that, again, is what we don't understand about addiction. It's not even about the substance or what they're self-medicating with. It doesn't matter if it's sex, gambling, substances. Actually, it's about filling a hole. As I said, self-medicating doesn't really matter what they're using for that. It's about a mental health issue.
Yeah. And I guess maybe, I mean, this is very conjectury, but I feel like if Pete hadn't become a rock star, he probably would still
I'm sure. I mean, we don't know what went on in his childhood. To assume that Pete chose to be a heroin addict and how he would suggest that someone else take a different path is not really understanding the very complicated psychological nature of the illness.
Yes. Yeah. Gosh, a lot of heavy stuff.
We'll be back with some more fun, lighthearted bits next week, guys.
But we've got to have balance, you know.
Actually, you know, a listener sent us a very funny, embarrassing story that might be a good place to end.
Oh, yes. That was hilarious.
Guys, if you've listened the last couple of weeks, you know that me and Ellie have shared a couple of mortifying instances from our lives. As a little carrot that we were dangling for some reviews. Well, we're here to dangle another carrot, which is that for you real ones who listen all the way to the end, we will be sharing more embarrassing stories. And guys, those of you that have sent us yours, we are obsessed. Thank you.
Like, such a treat.
We love it. Guys, please all send in your embarrassing stories. We'll give you a flavour of what we're after with this particularly excellent one. So obviously anonymous.
Yep.
For the poor sweet hun.
The poor hun.
So guys, one of our fabulous listeners has said that their most mortifying and embarrassing story that they're still cringing about was, and I quote, I accidentally bought a sex toy on my manager's company credit card. I'm not entirely sure if she knows the precise nature of what I ordered or if our finance team know who I had to repay, but I am completely mortified and I need to find a new job.
Oh, Angel.
That is just like the stuff of nightmares.
I so empathize. That is something I could so easily have done myself.
It's quite a you thing to do. And so obviously we had to ask for more details. And one of the ways that she managed to try and style it out was having been asked for the confirmation email by her manager, she had to get a friend to Photoshop it to show another item.
Who knows? That is so good. How great.
Thank you so much for that. And please do send in lots more.
Also, it does make me think that I need to learn how to use Photoshop.
Yep.
Just in case it happens to me.
Yeah. Fraud. On that topic, I asked you this off air and you didn't tell me the story. So while we are wrapping up, I'm determined to hear it. Have you had a brush with the law? Please tell me all.
I've had the nerdiest brush with the law. It's so peak me. It's embarrassing. Basically, when I was, I think, 16, I was smoking outside Waterloo.
Were you in your uniform?
No, it wasn't the fact that I was underage. It was the fact that I was probably on the weekend. I was with my friend and I just dropped the butt of the cigarette outside Waterloo Station. But it's illegal to do that. You have to put it in the little metal things. And a fucking copper saw me doing that and came over to me and fined me.
On the spot,
60 quid. And we were sharing a cigarette as well. So it wasn't even a whole one.
So and you got the fine, not her? Or did she also get a fine?
I think she also got it.
A shared cigarette.
But I think we got fined each.
Oh, 60 quid each.
Anyway, and it must have been 16 because I would have had therefore no money of my own. I got a £10 a month allowance, so I couldn't afford to pay that fine on my own. So I had to tell my parents so they could pay it. But obviously my parents, who were like, I mean, they're headmaster and teacher, like the idea of me smoking is like absolutely, I mean, they would have cried. So I had to tell them, but I had to say, they were wrong. I wasn't smoking. They must have seen someone else do it. Like I was completely, I'm completely innocent.
Do you think they bought it?
Yeah, my dad complained to the to our MP,
and you let him do that.
Yeah,
that is too good. And yeah, so
well, no, I think I didn't realize he was going to do that.
Oh, okay.
But he complained.
Yes, you better complain. It was a miscarriage of justice, actually, Dad.
Yeah, so he complained to the Waterloo MP, whoever that was at that time, and the MP wrote back a letter with like evidence. I think it was like either maybe they had like CCTV footage or like a picture, or like maybe they just said that they had it, being like, we have clearly got evidence of your daughter smoking and dropping the cigarette.
Oh my God.
But my dad was so embarrassed on my behalf that he only told me this years later.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
So he just left it and
he paid the fine. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Because I think he was so believed. He so trusted me. I feel really bad. I know. He trusted me. Trust. He was like, poor Eleanor and her miscarriage of justice. Yeah. And actually,
God.
I was a lying little
bitch. Turd.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
No, actually, it still makes me feel really upset. Anyway, oh, Dad, that's
cute.
That's
really cute. Well, my one brush with the law was literally not even that bad as well, because we were in our uniforms, but I was like 17, 18 is when I was in sixth form, and me and two other girls had like taken a half day. I think we actually had a half day, to be fair. I don't think we bunked. And we were smoking a joint on Ealing Common, which is like near where I grew up. It's just a big green. And we were really close to the road. In hindsight, it was quite a bait spot. We weren't, you know, hidden amongst trees or anything. We were just sat near to the road in this open space in a circle in our uniforms smoking a spliff. And this police van drives past. And then like, we're like, oh God, the police van. So we try to like put it out and put it down. And then we just see the police van reverse all the way back down the road and drive up onto the common next to us. And they're like, right, girls, what are you doing? One of the three, it wasn't me, but someone else got up and ran. Me
hilarious.
And the two that were sitting there were like, what the fuck are you doing? We now look so guilty.
I can't.
Did she run away. He was like, where's your friend gone? And we were like, she needs the loo. She's just desperate for a wee suddenly. And they were like, right, girls, was that you smoking that marijuana we can smell? And we were like, no. Even though then we realised there were like lighters and a grinder like on the floor in front of us. It couldn't have been more obvious that it was us.
And they just let you off.
And they let us off, yeah, because I think they started to be like, well, why aren't you at school? And we're like, oh, we've got half day and stuff. And we're like, we're in sixth form though. And then they were, I think knowing we were in sixth form and not under 16 sweetened it a bit.
Yeah.
And then they were like, oh, what are you doing for your A-levels? And one of my friends who's very clever, she was like, I'm actually doing maths, economics and history. And they were like, bloody hell, that's a bit of a mouthful. Gosh. All right, girls. Well, you know, you shouldn't really be doing this, but you know, you just make sure that you concentrate hard on those A-levels, okay? And you do get that friend to come back when she can, all right? It was like winks and then like drove off and that was it.
I can also imagine you being an absolute little dream with the police and sweetening them up.
Oh yeah, we were obviously like fluttering our eyelashes at them all the way. Right, before we end though, I have to know about what you did for Issa's birthday. I've been clacking to know about your bar. Honeys, if you're anything like us, you love to know about all the hot cocktail spots. So give it to me. Where the hell did you take
him? So I took him for a 5 p.m. martini. So chic at the Beaumont Hotel, which has a bar called Le Magritte, which is named after the surrealist painter. And I would say that it's so cozy, perfect for now the November rainy nights. It was actually torrential rain when we got there. We'd run through rain without an umbrella. We needed warm, toasty, old-fashioned Chesterfields, and that's
it's
exactly
Mayfair,
what we have.
Right?
Yes, it's right Beaumont by Green Hotel. Park Station. Yeah.
So it's got that kind of old classic London glamour style.
Everything looks really lovely, despite it being so old school. There was jazz playing, amazing little snacks. We had some beef sliders, French toast with cheddar and jam.
Oh, stunning. I love savory French toast.
And then I'm in my martini era, babe. I am done with margs. I know we've just been drinking them, but in terms of a bar order, I am bored of the humble marg.
Okay.
And I keep seeing as well on the internet that it is the year of the martini.
It's the year of martini. I think Stylist did a cover story a couple of weeks ago.
You feel like such an elegant hun with
but
a ordinary martini.
But it tastes like petrol to me.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yes. But you could also get it flavoured. I went to a dinner party recently where the host, who is also a chef, had whipped up an Earl Grey martini.
Oh, okay. I'd like that.
It was really good.
I mean, I do like a flavoured martini. I think I also am just perhaps too much of a lightweight to be on the martinis.
Yes.
I'd be legless after. Is it Duke's, the classic martinis bar?
They
actually don't let you have two.
Yeah, they you can have two and that's the max.
Yeah.
Same with the Connaught as well. But yes, I really recommend the Magritte, guys. It's at the Beaumont Hotel, right by Green Park Station. And also do order the Spiced Royale Smoky and Peppery Pisco.
Ooh.
So
good. Yum. Well, that sounds stunning, honey. That sounds like a perfect little December Christmas treat.
Also good for parents, I think, if you need to take your parents on a
special
little drink. Cute. Get them to pay.
Yeah.
Ideal.
Well, I thought you were going to be if you want to take your parents for one of their birthdays or something.
Well, yes.
Let us know if you've got any spots. I want some listener echoes. I want some
listener echoes.
Bar and restaurant spots. They
across
don't have to be
the
UK. Yeah, across the UK. To be honest, any other major cities in the world, I'll take those. We might need them for a mini break or a little holiday at some time.
Exactly. When we do a straight up tour across the...
across the world.
Across the world.
Yeah. Oh, and that's at a straight up pod on Instagram.
Yes.
We like to receive our DMs there. We like even more written reviews on Apple.
Yeah, you've been really good, guys. Well done.
Thank you. Very, very kind. We have seen them and we really appreciate.
Five more and Kathleen
will be back with another embarrassing story.
What will we do? I mean,
I've definitely got some. I'll just have to have a little think about it.
Or we'll just do something embarrassing so we can then tell you about it.
Yeah. That is our lives.
Right,
guys. See
off
you next
we trot.
Time.
Bye.